Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today, I'm going to talk about Leon Trotsky and war communism. I've dealt with this topic many times before, both in writing and in these podcasts. It comes up again and again and again. In fact, I was just on a radio show today where the question of nationalist organization was concerned. And the issue was whether or not it should be a decentralized kind of federation or whether it should be a centralized, highly disciplined system. And my remark was that the Bolsheviks won in the Civil War, at least in part because their system was brutally centralized. There was a single official ideology, there was no deviation from it, and complete loyalty was, at least during the period of the war, was demanded and was enforced. The whites had no such thing. Now, that's not the only reason the Reds won the war, but as many of you know, many years ago, in the late 80s, I was a musician. That's what I did. I would be doing that if the world were normal. But the world is not normal, so I was called to this kind of work. And in 1989, in 1990, the Soviet Union imploded. I think I said this before, but on Christmas Day of 89, Ceausescu was shot. And I'm watching this on TV. I was a kid, the 17, and I said, if this can happen overnight, this monolithic block is now falling apart, no one predicted it very quickly, then I'm signing up. There's, again, this is the era to be studying this stuff in, and political science and history. And at the time, I was a student of Donald Paul Rosenberg. Don Rosenberg is a Jew who converted to the Russian Orthodox Church in the 1970s. He's still at the parish council at the Cathedral of Our Lady of the Sign in Manhattan, the Synod Abroad, and was the right-hand man for Roy Cohn when he knew the end of his career in Manhattan in New York City. And Don is an encyclopedia, especially of American conservatism. I was kind of your typical Paul Weyrich-style conservative back in the late 80s. It wasn't until the Buchanan campaign of 92, when I was in New Hampshire for that, that I really became kind of paleo and then a nationalist. Very different things, and it's the small nuances that that change everything. The tiniest little things can lead to, much later on, huge fissures in movements and in personalities. The point is, I was studying the Soviet Union from day one. I come into this practically the day, the Warsaw Pact ceased to exist. Every day, the New York Times, these huge block headlines, I still have them, the Soviet Union falling to pieces, that no one had predicted just a few months before. And so I began reading about the Russian Revolution, so-called revolution. It really was a civil war and a coup. There was no revolution in the popular sense of the term. There was a revolution in the philosophical sense of the term. But this was a long, drawn-out war. And I read, I continued to read now for 26 years, without a break, without much of a vacation, the Russian Revolution, Civil War, and right up to the Stalinist era. And there's a few things that stick out to me that doesn't get talked about. And the mainstream literature is useless. These people just say the same things over and over. They're so stagnant and scared of being called names. I don't even read them anymore. I'm at a point now where I read nothing in English in terms of Russian history. It's useless. But I'm noticing, number one, that Lenin isn't that important. I used to think he was a dictator. He was the first. Trotsky was the engine, the mind, the money behind the movement. Lenin was a theoretician. Lenin was not the all-powerful dictator that I thought he was, number one. Number two, Marxism wasn't important. There's nothing about labor or the workers and anything that the Reds did, especially in the early years. Throughout the foundation of Soviet Marxism, mostly with Western capital, workers were treated like absolute cattle, absolute garbage. Any attempt of self-organization, whether it be in the countryside or in the cities, was quashed any attempt at equality, any attempt at building something remotely like socialism, was violently quashed. Number three, Leon Trotsky personally was not a Marxist. And I've read everything he's written, at least the major things, some of his letters, things like that. He labor is not a major, unless you know the definition, proletarian, labor, kulak. These are very specialized concepts in his mind. You know, Jacob Schiff was a member of the proletariat, if you asked Leon Trotsky. And yet a poor priest in Siberia would be an elite, a capitalist elite. I mean, that's how he thought. It's easy to exaggerate the Jewish nationalism in Trotsky. But Trotsky personally was not a Marxist. He believed, at least in Russia, or at least probably in Christian Europe, that workers were lazy, that workers under any system needed to be forced, even terrorized, to do the work of a society. That is 180 degrees away from Marxism that says that mankind loves work, loves labor, so long as he's in control of the production, the product, where it goes, and how it's made, that the application of skill, your vocation, and this is quite a legitimate point, is really absolutely essential here. Labor is unalienated when it is free, when you own the means of production, when you're not taking orders, including from the market. You're not taking orders as far as how the product is made, what product you make, and what happens to it later on. Trotsky believed none of that. And yet, the concept that man loves to labor, man, so long as he's free, is a working man, that is, Trotsky throws that out the window. Nothing in his policy. Now, he may, you know, the concept of proletarian in his mind is urban, is very Jewish, although not exclusively so. The peasants were never proletarians or peasants in a typical Marxist sense of the word. They were counter-revolutionaries. Class in terms of money income or property ownership had nothing to do with anything in Trotsky. I guess by 2005, I had taught myself Russian. I took German in college and grad school. I taught myself Russian, just a reading ability. Speaking is out of the question, but reading is no problem. And I went through so many of the Soviet laws in the first decade or so, and the workers aren't really spoken of at all. Unless in that with a capital W, and they're referring to the party. But workers are treated like absolute garbage. They're herded from place to place. They're treated very much as means to an end. And the party, members of the party, especially the elites, are really the only people who get the term proletarian with a capital P. From that, I began to extrapolate in other areas of history that you can't take these people's word for. When someone is talking about, say, God, or the workers, the proletarian, or Christ, or the nation, don't assume that your definition of the term is what these people are using. Quite often, they're going out of their way to use a common term, but secretly, in an occult sense, define it very differently. And that's what Trotsky is doing. He wasn't to the occult to some extent. To the extent that he was a Mason. To them, Masons were amateurs. Trotsky, but you know, he was into violence. He was into force. He was a diabolically brilliant military leader in the sense that he had no scruples. That he was a consistent materialist. If you're a consistent materialist, then the desk that I am sitting near has as much value as the human being. In fact, there's no good reason to distinguish the desk from the human being. That's arbitrary. If you're going to be consistent about it, destroying one or destroying the other, it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is utility. And now, as far as Trotsky is concerned, the only thing that matters is the power of the party. The last thing that I noticed studying the Soviet Union, took a while for this to penetrate, because everything is so contextualized poorly in academia. I noticed that when a planning agency, the early planning agency in the USSR, and Gosplan later on, is able to decide entire sectors of the economy, their future, how they're to be organized, that implies that they own it, that they possess it. That also implies that the party owns the entire economy. Further, that implies that this party elite owns the entire economy. And it finally hit me that war communism, this highly centralized kind of early, almost proto-Soviet system, just after the Civil War, was a means to justify, to make efficient, the transfer of wealth from peasants, workers, whoever else, to the party, to a handful of party elites. So ownership was immensely concentrated. Marxism had nothing to do with this. You could use any ideology and redefine the key terms any way you want and call yourself that. A proletarian is someone who is rootless. A proletarian is somebody who has at one time possibly had a home in the countryside and who, because of economic circumstances, has been forced into the city. That's a proletarian. In the city, he owns nothing. He is not a property owner. He is not a farmer. He has no real religious background, ethnic background. He does what he's told. He's regimented. The proletarian is another word for a Jew in Trotsky's mentality. It's the same thing. It's a rootless group of people who have been torn from their old lifestyle, in this case, many centuries ago, have abandoned that and have become very, very different people. Wanderers, completely rootless, pushed around from place to place because of economic necessity. So he's using proletarian to refer to this Jewish elite and the handful of men who were supporting him, non-Jews who were supporting him. I've said this before, and I'll say it many more times. When Trotsky was killed, he had two bank accounts. And I've read in Russian two very, very different figures, that he was certainly a billionaire. He had a bank account in New York City. He had a bank account in Geneva. Both gold and currency, different dollars and other major currencies of the world at the time. He was a billionaire. What happened to that money, I don't know. And what precise amounts were in those accounts, I don't know. They were foreign accounts. They weren't necessarily able to be dominated by Stalin or anybody else. But when he was killed, finally, he lived in a mansion in Mexico. You know, he lived a very bourgeois lifestyle. But being a Jewish revolutionary who was tearing down churches in the Soviet Union, by his definition, he was a worker. He was a proletarian. The term proletarian and the way that the kind of atheist Jews viewed themselves and viewed the world are very similar concepts. So you can't take these people's word for it. And you're dealing with all kinds of, you know, arcane ideologies throughout history. The left-hand path, so to speak, has one element of themselves that they present to the public, and the truth of the matter, they keep to themselves. Only after a certain amount of chaos and preparation can this alchemy be put into place where they could finally be given the full understanding. Michael Hoffman is the man who turned me on to this many years ago, and he was researching the 18th century Rosicrucians when he was at Harvard University in the libraries there, and he noticed the concept of the revelation of the method, that once the ruling class is in power and is very secure in their place, they will slowly but surely begin admitting that it's all been a sham, that in essence the monarchists were right, and you're being dominated and manipulated, and this has nothing to do with freedom or liberty or markets or anything else. And they will slowly do that. I think here in early June 2016, increasingly, the ruling classes, finance capital, and media are simply just coming out and saying, we rule everything, what are you going to do about it? The key element for me was the bank bailouts. Several times, both in the Bush administration and under Obama, the major banks that had victimized American homeowners went under. And they allowed the average American to go bankrupt. Back in 2007, there were about 600,000 bankruptcies a year. But if you were a member of the major clans, you were not permitted to go bankrupt. So not only had the American population, middle-class American population, it doesn't really exist anymore, they lost everything in these banking speculations and how they invested and then reinvested the debt. But now they were being extorted to get more money out of them, more equity out of them, to bail out the same people who had just taken advantage of them. I remember very when I first read about TARP, when I first read about this, how these troubled investments were to be made good by the banks, and I first read this their propaganda about it, and I said, this is it. If Americans don't take immediate action, immediate violent action against City Hall, whoever it is, you know, then nothing will move them. If this doesn't move them, then nothing will move them. Because the average American, which I use as a pejorative, the average American will do nothing unless it has some immediate pragmatic value defined by them as having something to do with money and putting food on the plate in front of them, quite literally in their case. Here you had the hardest core bread and butter issue, their savings, their income, and so they were being fleeced twice in a very, you know, a short period of time between, say, 2000 and 2007. And then they were extorted for even more money to bail out the people who had just fleeced them. That money has then been reinvested elsewhere. And of course, that profit went to the major banking clans. People forget that even when, you know, Greece defaulted on their loans last year, the banking, the major, there's only four or five major banking houses had profited massively from that debt, which is easy to do when you could simply, you know, say that money is created not through the printing press, but simply through you typing things in. You know, money has value because we believe it does, and we have no choice but to use it. The profits were made there. They're always making profits. You know, they can't get into any kind of trouble, especially since they control the political process. But when they were bailed out and it was on the front page, you know, Joe Moron, Main Street saw this and did nothing. That was something very close to what Hoffman and his the people he's talking about, 18th century New England and England itself, is revelation. This is what we're doing to you. We're forcing you. We'll let you go bankrupt. But we're forcing you to bail our friends out. Now, it just so happens that if you go to the Federal Election Commission website, you can see the money that the major banking clans, you know, I was talking about Goldman Sachs before it was cool. Now everybody is. $16 million to both McCain and Obama. Roughly that figure, that election cycle. Huge amounts of money to both parties. Since no politician has any real command over economic theory or the day-to-day mechanisms of finance, they get told what to do. As an aside, I should mention that presidents in America largely are figureheads. Presidents have very little real power. They can barely keep their cabinet under. They can barely keep their families under control. They can barely keep their cabinet under control. The U.S. government, which is largely privatized anyway, is made up of career bureaucrats who can't be fired, who have a lot more experience than the president, who are essential to making anything happen at all. These, from the machinery's point of view, the bureaucracy is absolutely essential. They've been around longer than the president. They are self-perpetuating. And then the bankers who keep it all going, the state can't exist for 2 minutes without credit from the private sector. And of course, the courts. The courts are dictators. The Supreme Court says that something is a law or not a law as they see fit. And the only general criterion is that the ruling class demands it. The entire social revolution of the late 1960s came from the Supreme Court. No one voted on anything. In fact, in 1972, they voted vehemently against all of that stuff by rejecting McGovern and electing Richard Nixon, and Nixon was punished through the Watergate scandal, which was a concoction of the Washington Post. Now, I say all of this because I don't like hearing people talking about, you know, Obama's foreign policy. That Obama and the Obama administration has a foreign policy towards Ukraine. Up until a few years ago, he couldn't find Ukraine on a map. None of those guys could. He knew not the first thing about that. policy is being made by major banks, energy firms in that case in particular, and career bureaucrats from the diplomatic service, the State Department, not to mention intelligence and multinational groups like NATO. Obama does not have a foreign policy. He is a domestic-oriented president. He had one thing, really, the healthcare thing, which was rewritten, this massive bill, which he probably never read. And that was pretty much his one thing. People, you know, these are personalities that are placed on television. That's all they are. You see this with investments. The Texas Rangers was bought by a group of investors a few years ago, and they used Nolan Ryan as their spokesman. I read in the paper, Nolan Ryan buys a share of the Texas Rangers. And I fell for it for a while. No, he was just somebody who was used to be the face of that power. I've said in this show before, the Medici clan in Florence, Italy, in the Renaissance, is the archetype for us. They took over and they ruled Florence as a financial dictatorship. They not only controlled the political machinery, but also the arts and the sciences. Galileo, the great painters of the era, these were under the control and the grant-making power of that family. But bankers don't like the idea of announcing that they're running everything, because they have no right to run anything, because they don't produce anything. They're the very lowest of all the economic categories. They are so far removed from actual production that it really gets so abstract, it's almost absurd. So they maintain the older Republican system in Florence, but controlled every little aspect of it. Became so comfortable that they put their own family on the papacy, the chair at Rome. But in general, they hid behind the older Republican idea. And this is what Machiavelli was talking about. Whether or not he really believed in this kind of thing, or he was just really telling the world, this is what the future holds. This is the nature of finance capital. Whatever he meant by all of that. And there's good arguments on both sides. It doesn't matter, because it works either way. Is that the people who now have power know that they have no right to have it. People who have power now are very far away from actually doing anything or making anything of value. They manipulate computer programs that are about representations of currency that in and of itself is a highly abstract a symbol for actual production on a global scale. I mean, that's how far away from reality they are. And from the Medicis onward, their policy has been to manipulate society because they don't have the right to rule anything. They have to manipulate you. This was Machiavelli's whole thing. Banking is the lowest of all the economic categories. I mean, Aristotle said that the merchant class was the lowest because they didn't actually make anything. But banking is even lower than that because a merchant gets his capital from banking. And because of that, you know, it's not like, you know, an industrialist that builds a country has power. That's bad enough. But these people are the ones who are even more abstract than that. They have no right to rule, yet they rule absolutely. And they rule a state that is more powerful and more efficiently organized than any other dictatorship in history, including the Soviet one. Now, why am I mentioning all of this? It sounds like I'm off topic. I am not. Because the way that Trotsky ran the Soviet Union, and prior to Stalin, it was Trotsky as the man who ran the machinery, the Red Army, the intelligence services, his people were in charge, and it's always been odd. Lenin is the one non-Jew in this entire regime. It's almost like, you know, Freud needing Jung to have at least one non-Jewish name there. The feminists using Catherine MacKinnon, just someone who wasn't Jewish and not ugly, just someone to use as a figurehead there. So you can't say they're all Jews. They needed one person. And Lenin was that one person. There's always one person who's not. So in Russia in the 1990s, the exact same process occurred. The production, the entire Soviet history, whether it be from the gulags or from ordinary workers, was liquidated and placed in the hands of a handful of oligarchs. But this was known and understood by the economics department of Harvard University, which I don't know why still exists. It has no credibility whatsoever. federal government did sue them for what amounts to economic malpractice, and they won. So these guys, and I have a paper on my website, rushjournal.org, talking about Harvard's criminal record. You know, they have no credibility in any of these fields. They knew that they were creating an oligarchy, that they were serving an oligarchy, moving from the bureaucracy or the black market to power. You don't have to win elections. You have to control the money. Vladimir Putin, when he does something that doesn't sound nationalist, what he's trying to do, and this is very important, he's trying to bring some of that capital back home. It's in foreign bank accounts, just like Trotsky's bank accounts were. And he has to be nice to certain people because there's still billions of dollars that is owned by the Soviet, by Russia, and made by their workers that is still in banks in New York or Switzerland. He can't just kind of hang all these people. He'd love to. He'd be the most popular man in the world if he did. He can't do that because they know where this money is and they can be coaxed. And he has been successful in that. In fact, he's even offered some of these oligarchs a tax freedom if they bring some of this money back. We'd have to do the same thing if we were in his position. The broader point of connecting Trotsky to the American system, to the bailouts and everything else, the point is that oligarchy rules the exact same way. Trotsky talked about Marxism and the proletariat in a way that Karl Marx never understood, or any socialist ever understood. Trotsky was a Marxist in the same sense that Lorenzo de' Medici was a Republican. These were symbols that were used to manipulate people. They simply either redefined the institutions, manipulated the institutions, or just redefined the word. What's essential in political discourse is that the words that we use are constantly undergoing redefinition. And when young people, they first start out, they think they know what they're talking about, and they use words like democracy as if they're referring to this mechanism of voting in campaigns. That's not what it means. Democracy is identical with liberalism in the public mind. That's taken about 20 years to redefine that term. But that's just one example of political terminology that's been completely altered. So Trotsky uses a word like proletarian. He has a very specific definition in mind. And this is why he can actually say, you know, Jacob Schiff is a leader of the proletariat, or a leader of the proletariat. You know, Jacob Schiff could be, but a right-wing peasant in Ukraine needs to be liquidated because he's a member of the capitalist ruling class. That's the mentality. There's something else that struck me the last 20, whatever it is, 26 years of reading Soviet history, is that the White Army had every advantage. The White Army had more money. They had more men. And yet they lost the war. They lost it badly. They were disorganized. They had no political agenda. They treated everyone like military men rather than politicians, which was a huge mistake. They're because they had no real agenda, they could produce no loyalty. You supported the whites because you hated the reds. That's pretty much it. But the main reason, in my view, apart from all that, that the whites lost the war is that they had no supplies. When I was in grade school, high school, college, grad school, I heard that the West intervened, meaning the Entente, intervened in the Russian Civil War to stop Bolshevism and to assist the whites in creating a government that will keep Russia in World War I. Or at least afterwards, that will keep Russia from joining with Germany. That's what I heard. None of it is true. Because the creators of Bolshevism were using American capitalism as their primary underwriter, the differences between Bolshevism and capitalism are academic. Workers are treated the same. The state is pretty much the same. You know, rather than having camps, you know, we have counseling and we have re-education in prisons and in America. Actually, there's more Americans in prison or on probation than was in the Soviet Gulag at any given time. A huge part of the American economy is based on these prisons, just like it was a big part of the Soviet economy is based on the Gulag. I think people are treated a little bit better in American prisons than in the Gulag. But the system is, they're eerily the same. They're materialist. They believe in linear progress. They believe in basic mechanization. They believe that the progress is in economic and scientific terms. They're positivists. You know, they reject anything. They're nominalists. You know, the things like this, you know, collectivism and collectivization is not the same thing as communitarianism. The collection is just taking any group of individuals and forcing them together. Community can only be done if these people have something in common. It's got to be the language and some very foundational aspect that makes a community out of it. A community can't be made out of nothing, but a collection can be. And but be very careful when we use terms like the communist. You know, they didn't believe in communes. They believed in collections imposed by force, essentially randomly done, and in the countryside, run by urban Jews that didn't know the first thing. Not only didn't know the first thing about farming, but hated the farming life. Now, you have a situation where this new ruling class, run by Trotsky, financed by American bankers, and whenever they got in trouble, received food aid from the Red Cross, Woodrow Wilson, whatever they needed. They had no interest in labor. Labor was treated absolutely abysmally far worse than ever before. There were real social protections in Tsarist Russia. Those were gone and never resuscitated in the Soviet Union. You had no interest really in production because it was American capital that came in and built the mines, the oil wells, and the Gulag itself. The USSR was electrified by GE. The automotive industry, I know some people, I have to break your bubble here, but it was Henry Ford who built the largest truck plant in the world in eastern Ukraine, near Kharkiv, in the 30s. And that became, they had the Soviet Ford, and the entire Soviet automotive industry, in the broad sense, came from that one plant. GE's plant was also the largest of its kind in the world. And mind you, this is done while the U.S. is in a depression. Americans can't find work, but GE and Henry Ford and Sears and the major and Standard Oil in the southern part of the country, near Baku, they're investing millions of dollars to build socialism. The other thing that you should observe, though, is how many people in the U.S. government knew what Bolshevism was. It's three at most. Very few people spoke Russian that weren't born and raised there. Russian history was almost completely unknown by professional historians or anybody else. They couldn't make any sense of it. The problem with that is rumor and manipulation became truth. You know, Johnson's Law, we all know what this is. The more obscure the country, the easier it is for elites to lie about it and make it be believed. Because there's so few people who can refute them, they can say whatever they want and no one's going to say anything. And no one really can, and no one, a lot of people don't care. Very few people knew what Bolshevism was. Very few people knew Russian. Very few people knew anything about Russian history or what was going on over there. And if you read English language, whether it be English or American accounts, what was going on in the Soviet Union, say, or from, say, 1905 in Tsarist Russia, right up to the Stalinist era, it is laughably inaccurate. I couldn't believe I was, when I was teaching at Mount St. Mary's in the history department there. I taught there for 5 years. The late, great Bob Callis, who was chairman of the department who hired me, he came to my office with a newspaper clipping from 1906, I believe. And it referred to, it was an American publication, American journalists in Western Russia, and they were referring to the Tsars, or the Emperor, Nicholas II, using Apaches to destroy the revolutionaries. And he said, what the heck, Apaches? Are they Indians over there? And I'd never heard this before. And I'm looking at this. I've read it. And now he showed me three or four other clips where they're saying the Apache Indians are being used by the Tsar. I know it. They're Cossacks. But they don't know what they are. They look a little bit like Indians because they have the top knot, the ponytail, the braid off the top of their head. You know, they have the similar, you know, they're all always on horseback, very attuned to the topography, that they have certain things in common with the Indians in American life. Having no idea what a Cossack was, the major, they were referred to as Apaches. And it took me a day to figure this out. I had never seen that before, but now I'm seeing it everywhere. If you go to that era, that's how little they knew about Russian life. They just gave a name to these people. I mean, they didn't really think there were Indians over there. But because they had a vague similarity in how they looked, I mean, that's how little was known. You could read nothing and have any faith in it. Especially, that. I mean, now it's bad enough. But back then, it was simply concocted. It was completely invented from whole cloth. There was one person in particular, was Herman Bernstein, who controlled both, whether it be in the Evening Post and the Independent. He founded his own Jewish nationalist papers in America. Herman Bernstein he did speak Russian. He's from there. And he pretty much filtered and created a lot of the news that American newsmen got. So they're using him as crib notes to write their articles. And he was a revolutionary and a Jewish nationalist. And he saw Zionism and Marxism, at least in the sense that it was being used in the Soviet Union, as complementary ideas, like Moses Hess. So you had a situation even worse than now. Now, when the riots took place, started in 2013 in Kiev, you don't have tons of Ukrainian specialists over there. You have people who know a few things here and there, but they didn't know, you know, their reporting was awful. They didn't know certain historical figures that they had completely they didn't mention properly. The Berkut, the police unit, they were referring to as a person. And then Fox News, it was a building, then it was a region. They had no idea what it was. And that just made me laugh at the time. But then, you know, it quickly turned to tears because nothing that they said made any sense or was true. And in this case, possibly out of ignorance, as much as anything else, they ended up, you know, correcting all of that. They finally figured out what Bukut was. But there, and then the American politicians were going over there and encouraging this extreme violence, which now has led to, as everyone who knows anything about Russia predicted, a poverty level that no one has seen before. Ukraine is a fourth world country. It is absolutely heartbreaking. It is a beautiful place. It is a high IQ country. It was the not just the agricultural center of the Soviet Union, but the chemical center, the electrical center, the scientific center, the industrial center of the Soviet Union. That is now reduced to, economically speaking, about what Ghana, Chad, Mali, and Africa are pretty much their level. Not just in terms of economic production, but, you know, corruption and everything else. A complete disaster. Both Orange Revolutions ended up the same way, and the same people accepted both revolutions, even though they knew the second Orange Revolution, they were aware that the first one was a complete disaster, and the country continued to plunge into poverty and had no legitimacy. But it started up again in 2013. They learned nothing, and they accepted it again. And the worst part was seeing Ukrainian nationalists doing the bidding of Goldman Sachs. Now, I need to say something here. I have a book coming out on Arctos Press on Ukrainian nationalism and the history of Ukrainian political thought. I hear quite often that these people, Ukrainian revolutionaries in Kiev, were neo-Nazis, which is the term that people use and they don't know anything. And they use Bandera. Again, they usually don't know his first name, but they use that name as some kind of a pejorative. Now, I've read Bandera in detail. He certainly was a social nationalist, but had no truck with Hitler. He saw Hitler as someone he could be used to liberate the country from Stalin, but that was a natural, normal, and praiseworthy idea. Now, from the last podcast, you guys have heard Eric Cook and his disaster in Ukraine yet again. That was ruined. And because of people like Cook and Himmler's view towards Slavs, being a neo-Nazi in Ukraine doesn't make a whole lot of sense. That's not what they are. Bandera, so many other people, Donstov, were nationalists in the Ukrainian sense, no different than the Irish were in the Irish sense, Russians are in the Russian sense. You change the names around, the names of the countries, the labels, and it's the same ideology. None of these guys, Bandera especially, no one in the OUN trusted the West. They weren't Western. They were either, you know, Byzantine Union or Orthodox people. They didn't believe, and Bandera says this over and over again, that the West is helpful at all. Well, you know, Bandera and his crew did not believe the West was fighting communism. They knew what we're talking about here, that the West was building communism. They had just destroyed nationalism. Hitler was not a nationalist. He was, he was an empire builder, but he had destroyed the concept of nationalism, because nationalists were throwing their lot in with Hitler, and the world was then divided up between Trotskyism and Roosevelt liberalism. Bandera, there's simply nothing wrong with the guy. Theoretically speaking, he was a national socialist in the best sense of the word. And people who, you know, don't read him or can't read him, use the Nazi label because they don't know what else to say. Labels are dangerous. Labels describe nothing, and they evoke nothing but an emotional response. The minute people start throwing out labels, that there's a problem. Labels are not knowledge. They're shortcuts to knowledge. Which is, by the way, the central concept of my doctoral dissertation, the manipulation of language in revolutionary situations. So there's nothing wrong with the Ukrainian nationalists. Their arguments are sound. They were always treated as foreigners up until the Soviet era. And the Orthodox Church in tradition is very different from that of Moscow. And there's simply nothing wrong with an independent Ukraine, at least Cossack Ukraine, in union with and being in the same customs union as Moscow. There's nothing wrong with that. But to see nationalists knowingly serving global cosmopolitanism, pretending that Bandera would actually support this sort of thing, and the OUN would ever support it, it's nonsense. I had a paper out a while ago on the Patriarch Vladimir, who was a traditionalist patriarch of the Ukrainian church, not from the 1921 Sobor, that was destroyed and it has no successors. At least none who matter. It was from the Tomos of Antioch in 1924, creating the Orthodox Church of Poland, which really, because it was 7/8 Ukrainian, the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, immediately condemned by Russia. And Tikhon, saying Tikhon unfortunately made an error, a terrible error, in condemning them and trying to quash them, and associating them with the 1921 debacle. That's for a different time. I have other podcasts on that question. So you have ignorance, opportunism, and when you have reporting that's that bad, you have Ukrainian nationalists, national socialists in America supporting Poroshenko. There's a certain level of stupid that you can't really describe using the English language. You get dumber just trying to consider it, especially since these people know that the 2004 disaster was just that, a complete disaster. Ukraine is not an independent country and has not been for many years. It is completely subject to its financial creditors. They control the government. Most of the cabinet and under Poroshenko is not Ukrainian. And they have to report into the American embassy at least once a week to go over policy. Ukraine is a ward of the West, although because Ukraine has no functional economy and no functional currency. What little it has comes from loans, which really are grants, from the IMF. There's going to be a time where the West, that can't afford pretty much anything on its own turf, is not going to write any more checks. The Ukrainian army doesn't exist. These are mercenaries that were being paid for by U.S. taxpayer dollars that have been defeated over and over again by the militias of Eastern Ukraine. And to cover over their embarrassment, they have pretended that the Russia invaded the country, which, by the way, was reported in every major newspaper. No such invasion occurred. There are, as of right now, I think there are about 100 volunteers from the Russian forces that are advising the fairly well-trained people. They had been drafted at one point when they had conscription, the militias in eastern Ukraine. There are far more American and NATO advisors in Ukraine advising the government, what's left of it. So you can't say Poroshenko did X, the Ukrainian government in Kiev did X. That doesn't make sense. They have no decision-making power. There is no functional economy. There is no functional currency. It is essentially what's happening is that it's being parceled off and sold off to pay debts. The reason you have the National Socialist National Bolshevik Revolution in Eastern Ukraine is that they tried to take the coal mines and the steel plants of that part of Ukraine and simply sell it off for to pay debt. And it would have even made a dent in it anyway. But the workers there refused to let that happen. And they started shooting, though in this case, they won. And you have two, and their economies are actually growing in this mess, believe it or not. Crimea certainly is because they have Chinese investment coming in. And as soon as the war is over, you have investment throughout the customs union coming into Eastern Ukraine. And with a strong, you have a similar system in Belarus. This is the opposite of what we're talking about, whether it be with Poroshenko or Trotsky. It's the same materialist idea. The one big exception is that Trotsky actually did rule something. But the ideology, the materialist, the concept, the historicism, this is exactly the same. Trotsky and the Soviet Union was at war with the countryside. If they're being fed by the West, they don't have to worry that much about farm production. He imposed a 25% sales tax on everything that they created. The peasants were known in Ukraine and Russia for self-organization. They didn't need anyone's help. They are cooperative by nature. That's the nature of the Slavic peasant. Any attempt at self-organization on socialist models was quashed. Between 1928 and 1932, the money supply increased 500% with no production to back it up. Urban prices were far lower than rural prices, and that was artificial. Everything was tilted towards the urban sector. The urban sector is the only place where the communists had any support. It was very Jewish. And when these peasants came into the city, they became proletarians. Under the Tsars, peasants controlled, depending on who you read, between 92 and 98% of the land of old Russia. Whether it be the commune or individual plots, the church did not own much land at all because it had been secularized in the 18th century. The landlords were serving in the bureaucracy or elsewhere. They had nothing to do with the ownership of the land. The nobility was really not a part of that anymore. Nobility was to be found in St. Petersburg or in the regional capitals trying to be St. Petersburg. And in, as far as the White Army is concerned, White Army officers, about 11% were landowners with any kind of noble background at all. You had far higher percentage in the Red Armies. War communism was a method of restructuring the entire economic universe in the Soviet Union. Trotsky created it. Lenin had very little to do with it. Trotsky had all the guns, he had support, he had the Western bankers listening to him, and the Western bankers were with him because they were Jewish. And Trotsky was able to use some of that. He lived in New York City for a while, he was an American journalist for a while, he worked for the major papers in the West, as did Karl Marx personally. Now these people were clearly no threat to anybody. They were subsidized by these people, both in the state as well as in the private sector. War communism developed as a way to make the transfer of the entire country to the party easier. I have five elements that Trotsky, this is my own summary, that he demanded in the creation of this system, really the first centralized planned Soviet system during and right after the Civil War. At number one, private manufacturing was banned at all levels, even at the household industry. Household production was out of the question because he wanted tightly centralized, urban-based systems. The cottage industries were a threat because it meant that the village was now independent of the city. Number two, this trade was violently enforced. The trade ban, any attempt to show any kind of self-organization, even on socialist lines. If Trotsky either didn't know or didn't care what socialism was, he was not interested in that. He wanted to create an anti-Christian global empire. The bureaucracy, which at the time really was Yagpu, prior to the creation of the NKVD and the Cheka during the Civil War, they were overwhelmingly Jewish, but they also weren't large enough to cover the entire country. And so Trotsky developed the idea that arbitrariness is better than just constant pressure. If you never know when the hammer is coming down, you're going to be always off balance and always on your guard. Number three, all raw materials came under the state. That is to say, came under the party and came under the Red Army. Number four, I mentioned already, all forms of self-organization. The thing is, people realize, you know, old Russia and the peasant system, even in the cities, you had numerous Orthodox movements, the Brotherhood of the Holy Cross. I have a paper on that. You had many Christian socialist movements that were very successful throughout old Russia that never get any press and were the far bigger threat to Trotsky than anything else. These were egalitarian, labor-based societies that have been around a long time. The commune in Russia, of course, is clearly a vaguely socialist idea. And the monastery is far more radical in its organization than anything any communist ever came up with. And five, and this is the most important thing, it doesn't matter what we do so long as we can rely on aid from the U.S. or from the West. Trotsky invented the concept of feminism at this time. Stalin really made it more of a system because labor was being killed off very quickly. The Civil War, World War I, Trotsky's own extremely violent enforcement of every little thing. Labor shortage was extreme. You had a lot of people in exile. You had really not a whole lot of skilled labor. And this is why during the NEP period, right afterwards, up until Lenin's death, you had Western firms taking care of all of this. You didn't have trained technicians in Russia at the time. They were either dead or in exile or with the whites or too afraid to do much of anything. Western capitalist firms came in and built the Soviet empire. Whether they knew what Bolshevism was, it had nothing to do with equality. No one ever said in Russia it had anything to do with equality. The Reds, the Communist Party, and the Soviet Union never mentioned that at all. It was a party state defining itself in negative terms. The anti-Christian regime, the anti-Western regime, the anti-Orthodox regime, the anti-Russian regime. There's nothing Russian about the Soviet Union. They were at war with Russia. Any mention of Russian nationalism was quashed. I am very tired of hearing people mention that Joseph Stalin was a nationalist. Absolute nonsense. He condemned nationalism and was a cosmopolitan over and over and over again. When you read some of the academic papers in English, pretending that he was one, they take comments saying that, yes, Peter the Great was doing the right thing when he centralized power in Petersburg. That is not only a nationalist statement to them, but a monarchist statement. And for saying that, Peter the Great was a self-defined revolutionary and a Mason and a secularist. But that makes him a royalist and a nationalist. It's nonsense. He believed in none of that. He was not anti-Jewish whatsoever. He married two of them, and his children married Jews. He was surrounded by them. It just so happens that the old Bolsheviks were almost all Jewish. So if he was opposed to them because of Trotsky, then he was certainly looked at as anti-Jewish. Communism, really up until maybe in the 1950s and 60s, was seen as an ethnic movement there. This is something that Ukrainian nationalists in Belarus and Poland, it was seen as an ethnic movement. You know, communism, Bolshevism was seen as a Jewish creation for the sake of taking power. They're using a proletarian ideology as a secret symbol for themselves, but as a way to mobilize what they thought were the most progressive elements of society was urban labor, including urban skilled labor, which did not exist at the time in Russia. So feminism developed because of this massive labor shortage, and they needed to draft women. Now, a few things were going on. It's really then and now. Number one, family is always a threat to tyrants. It is a natural community, whereas collectivization, the Soviet system, was an unnatural collection rather than a community. Number two, women had the reputation up until recently as being the most conservative element of society. Being the guardian of the hearth, the woman was essential for religion, was essential for basic family customs as well as regional customs. The Old Believer movement had a tremendous female following early on for this reason. And the Priestless did have many women who were absolutely essential in organization and in doctrine, especially the Priestless in the North. That needed to be destroyed. Bringing the woman into the workplace in America is simply a way to quash wages and to control men. Women are, as I've written in an article elsewhere, the new nobility. They could send men to jail, very powerful men to jail, by being uncomfortable. It's happened many times, will continue to happen, without proof or evidence. This happens everywhere. Now, that wasn't the purpose so much in the Soviet Union, but the idea was that they were considered more docile, but just equipped to learn, as men were. Bringing women in meant that you had an automatic division between men and women, and that the more laborers you had, the less power any one laborer in particular possessed. So as always, it was the most anti-labor thing they could possibly do. In 1919, the British forces in the northern part of the country near Petersburg could have very easily toppled the Bolshevik government. They knew that at the time, and they refused. They refused because the Bolshevik government was being subsidized. Denikin, Kolchak, both in their memoirs say explicitly they did not receive a bullet, a penny from the West. They had the imperial treasury. And with all this gold, they couldn't buy anything because there was nothing, no one willing to sell to them. The weapons that they received were from captured Red stores. Red officers were received a regular salary, which is odd. Whites certainly didn't have that power. And near the end, they were on starvation rations. There was nothing like that at all in the Red Army. They were well equipped. They had field guns. They had intelligence. They had whatever they needed. The whites had very little. The West was bankrolling the Reds, especially when it became clear that the Reds would make a deal. The deal essentially was with Trotsky, was we will make trade concessions, debt concessions, even territorial concessions in exchange for peace and acceptance. The West immediately recognized the USSR until Roosevelt recognized it, although trade was substantial between the West and the USSR, which is odd if the two of them were enemies. If the U.S. was somehow frightened by Bolshevism, that it would be trading, and not just trading, but building them up. Stalin's idea was to send enough Russian workers to America to learn various trades and then bring them back to the point where they wouldn't need American capital anymore, which is exactly what happened, although trade between the two, including in various sensitive areas and high tech, was always substantial. So we're almost at an hour here. I need to conclude. I'm trying to cram a lot of information into a short period of time. Let me conclude with William Bullitt, the head of the U.S. intelligence in Petersburg. He fully backed Trotsky, and he said very explicitly that Trotsky was ours, meaning that he was under the control of American capital. Trotsky himself said, without Western assistance, the Red Army wouldn't last a week. He said if the whites had ever unified with outside money, the way that he was able to do with the Reds would have been completely destroyed. And finally, as the white armies evacuated in the Crimean region, it was the French and the English navies that sank the Russian fleet there. They were doing all the dirty work of the Red Army and the Red Navy, in fact, and then they were, so to speak, serving as the Red Navy. So I need to conclude this, wrap it up. I know I speak very quickly, getting a lot in here, but you get the picture. You also get how it connects with our own situation, how nothing seems to change here in terms of who rules and why. Thank you for listening. I appreciate your assistance, whether it be critical or laudatory. You're both very useful to me. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to
The Orthodox Nationalist
with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at Radio Aryan.com.